to also read, and then I think Natalie and maybe Genla and Jonathan.
I asked him to.
Yeah, he
say
maybe
something.
Has something to say, and who else usually? Amy, I think.
Amy has something.
And perhaps David. David maybe usually
he
has
says something.
Something.
I hope he says something.
So anyway. Chapter 3 in Bakshi's collection of translations called Jeweled Staircase is entitled Putting the Teachings into Practice. It begins by saying that to practice the Buddha's teachings, it is essential to adopt the four reliances. One, rely on the teaching and not on the person who teaches. Two, rely on the meaning and not on the words. Three, rely on definitive scriptures and not on those requiring interpretation. Four, rely on exalted wisdom and not on ordinary consciousness. Why do we celebrate Bakshi each year? It is to remember his kindness. In chapter 4 of the great treatise entitled Relying on the Teacher, we see that we must rely on the teacher in thought and in practice. One of the ways to rely in thought is to remember our teacher's kindness. But our celebration could easily be misinterpreted as a reliance on the person rather than the teaching. How is this celebration following the first of the four reliances, rely on the teaching and not on the person who teaches? To answer this, we must remember that the teaching is twofold, scriptural and realized. As the great treatise on the stages of the path to enlightenment states, the scriptural teachings determine the way that you take the teachings in hand, the procedures for practice. The teachings, as they are realized, are your practice of these procedures in accordance with how you have already determined them. Bakshi's kindness was to give us the Buddha's teachings. He taught us how to practice the teachings, the potential cause of our transformation. This then led to our transformation in accordance with how much we were able to apply Bakshi's instructions. So today we are practicing the teaching of remembering Bakshi's kindness, how he affected our lives, how he changed us on the inside, how he made our lives better. For each of us, this can be expressed differently. Some of us received his kindness directly and some of us indirectly. But his coming to this country has affected all of our lives in some positive way. Bakshi was a person of great integrity and honesty, wisdom and compassion. In 2003, at the first conference of American Dharma Centers, His Holiness the Dalai Lama praised him by noting that he planted the Tibetan teachings in the U.S. precisely in the manner prescribed by the Buddha, a pure seed that will give pure fruit. His Holiness also once referred to Bakshi as a bodhisattva while teaching a large monastic gathering in South India, much to Bakshi's delight. By holding this day of celebration of such a bodhisattva's deeds, we have an opportunity to collect good karma or merit, causes for future experiences of happiness. You don't need to have known Bakshi to do this. Those who have visited here today for the first time collect merit by their intention to be here. The action of getting here, their participation, and then their feeling good after it, about it afterwards. Those who underwent some hardship to get here collected more merit as a result of their determination. Even those who intended to come and could not make it collect merit by their intention. The opportunity to collect this merit is only here because of Bakshi's kindness. his kindness and how he sacrificed to make this all available to us without us having to make the great effort that he did. All of us should bring this fact to mind today. But especially those of us who knew Bakshi directly. Sorry, it's going to go up. But especially those of us who knew Bakshi directly have assembled to remember his kindness, how he changed our lives for the better. In order to remember the kindness of our teachers, Jay Tsongkhapa provides a passage from the Array of Storks Sutra in his great treatise. It goes as follows. I, Sudhana, have come here thinking one-pointedly. These are my teachers, instructors in the teachings, the ones who totally reveal the good qualities of all things and then fully teach the bodhisattva way of life. Because of giving birth to these qualities in me, they are like my mother. Because of giving me the milk of good qualities, they are like my wet nurses. They thoroughly train me in the branches of enlightenment. These teachers turn away agents of harm. Like doctors, they free me from old age and death. Like Indra, the chief of the deities, they let a rain of nectar fall. Like the full moon, they fill me with the white teachings of virtue. Revealing the direction of peace, they are like the light of the sun. With regard to friends and enemies, they are like mountains. They have a mind undisturbed, like an ocean. They wholly care for me, and are like pilots of a ferry. Thinking in this way, I have come here. These bodhisattvas have caused my mind to develop. They have produced my enlightenment as a Buddha's child. Therefore, these, my teachers, are praised by the Buddhas. With such virtuous thoughts, I have come here. As they protect the world, they are like heroes. They are captains, protectors, and refuge. They are an eye providing me with happiness. With such thoughts, I respect and serve my teachers. So I conclude my talk with Jay Tsongkhapa's advice, right after he quoted this sutra. In accordance with this statement, you should remember your teacher's kindness with these verses. Using a melody and substituting yourself for Sudhana. So, thinking of that, then we asked Machis to put this to a melody. And then we were going to hand it out, and we were all going to try saying it.
Josh,
singing it, really.
Please hand this out. Little Josh. Just hand this to everybody. You have your copy?
No, I like one of those. Those are fancy.
Yeah, one of the fancy guys.
So you want a seat up here?
Yeah, give him a chair. Name John.
Chair.
Give him a chair. Do you want it like that, or do you want someone to hold it for you? Someone can sit there and hold it for him.
No,
so, Joshua.
This is fine because it'll shake.
Really?
Yeah.
Tom, I didn't see you here. I didn't know you were here.
I'm glad Josh read it so you can see that. Can't really put it to music. It's, but and that's why we're going to create something together. This is going to be a an improvisation on this beautiful sutra, and you can't make a mistake. It's just improvisation means that it'll could be different tomorrow if we do it. It'll be different the next day, and it all comes from emotion. So we're gonna just try not to think too much and go with it. And there are parts of the sutra, as you just heard, throughout things like they are like my mother, they are like my wet nurses, let a rain of nectar fall. Those are opportunities that we can sing together or speak together or really feel what those beautiful words mean. So I thought we could just let this fly. And then when I hit those parts, I'll repeat them and sing them and repeat them. And you can sing along with me with the melody, or you can speak it, or whatever you feel. Like I said, we can't make a mistake. And you'll see where those parts come, because I'm going to stop and I'll just keep repeating them so we can feel them.
I have a question. When we do it, you know, we're not Sudana. We have to just quietly say our own name.
Yeah, I'm going to sing that part.
No, I'm just saying that, you know, I'm saying that each person has to, Jay Rinpoche said, right?
Well, just that one time.
Well, you still have to think your own name. We're not Sudana. He's a realized being.
You can think your own name at that person.
Yeah.
Or as we discuss, we could even say we. We could begin it with we.
Okay, we.
We have come here.
Okay. All right. Well, each,
so,
whatever.
Feel free.
Instructors in the teachings, the ones who totally reveal the good qualities of all things, and then fully teach the bodhisattva way of life. Because of giving birth to these qualities in me, giving me the milk of good qualities. They are like my wet nurses. 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 Thoroughly train me in the branches of enlightenment. But these teachers turn away agents of harm. Like doctors, they free me from old age and death. Like Indra, the chief of the deities. Thank you. the full moon, they fill me with the white teachings of virtue, revealing the direction of peace. They are like the light of the sun. 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 With regard to friends and enemies, they are like mountains. 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 They have a mind undisturbed like an ocean. 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 They wholly care for me and the light. Pilots of a ferry, like 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 pilots of a ferry. But thinking in this way, I have come here. Bodhisattvas have caused my mind to develop. They have produced my enlightenment. As a Buddha's child, as a Buddha's child, as a Buddha's child, as a Buddha's child, as a Buddha's child. Therefore, these my teachers are praised by the Buddhas. With such virtuous thoughts, I have come here. As they protect the world, they are like heroes. 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 They are captains, protectors, and refuge. They are an eye providing me with happiness. With such thoughts, respect and serve my teachers. I 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 respect and serve my teachers.
some of you out there on that. I mean, but it's such beautiful words. Thank you so much for being open to.
Thank you, Matisse. That was a great job. John, can you come up and read your poem now, or your writing, your composition?
Little Joshua, hand it out. He'll have it.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Got one copy of that one.
Yeah, we have.
Oh, okay.
Let's let it be.
Yeah.
Great.
Oh, that's great. That's a great one.
This is the one in Paul Hackett.
That's in Calhoun?
I don't know. Depends on where
he was young.
I was looking to see if Paul Hackett was here, but he isn't. There's a photograph you'll see on the front of this, which was taken of Geshe Wangyal in 1937.
Good, is that?
And this was shared with me by a teacher who was, well, first of all, a student at Columbia, and also now a teacher at the New School for Social Research, and his name is Paul Hackett. So that's it's in our hands because of his generosity. Since Geshe Wangyal died, I've been writing things twice a year.
Wait, while he was dying?
Hmm?
You started while he was dying?
Yes, I start doing a series of letters every day saying something. A is how altruistic he was, and B, how benevolent, and so forth. We got as far as enlightened, and that was the timing of his death. The first few were basically praise, but after a while it sort of became redundant because what good was that doing anybody? So I tried to pull essences of his teaching into each thing. Now, different people said, how wonderful, this can go on forever. And I said, that's not possible, because I'm not going to go on forever. And then mischievously, I kept thinking, maybe I can write about a dozen or 20 or 30 ahead of time. So after I kicked a bucket, someone can come and read. This is year one after John left, and so forth and so on. But I thought that would be too morbid. However, so when I'm gone, they're gone, all right?
And
you'll have to have, you'll have to do reprints. Once I put the glasses on, and David said, aha, you're getting old like the rest of us. And so then I threw the glasses across the room and read it without it. All honor to Geshe Wangyal. To continue your work, we say. I remember once upon a time, in the days of yore, immeasurable, inconceivable, immense, infinite, aeons ago, no long and long before, there was born a Tathagata called Nawang Wangyal, an arhat endowed with science and conduct, a sugata, a knower of the world, an incomparable tamer of men, a teacher and ruler of gods and men, a Buddha and Lord. He preached the law, which was holy in the beginning, holy in the middle, and holy at the end, complete and perfect, correct and pure. That is to say, that to the disciples he preached the law containing the chain of causes and effects, teaching to overcome birth, sickness, decrepitude, death, I'm sorry, old age, death, sorrow, woe, grief, and despondency, finally arriving at nirvana. And to the bodhisattvas, he preached the law connected to the six perfections, leading to the clairvoyance of the omniscient after the attainment of complete perfect enlightenment. And in the future, for immeasurable, inconceivable, immense, and infinite aeons, he will continue to preach the law through stories, legends, myths, the echoes of the Dharma, through the sounds of water, through the sound of the wind, through thunder, through the sound of our steps upon hard surfaces, through his footprints. Thank you. Is in 1937, and where it is, I don't know, but it came through the courtesy of Paul Hackett at Columbia.
This is at Marco Palace's house, right?
Yeah, it's probably in England.
Exactly that same.
He didn't stay at Marco's, he stayed at Andreas.
Well, wherever he was.
Marco's brother.
He was staying with Marco's brother, Andreas. That's where it must be.
I just have it, man.
Yeah.
John, you're starting to plagiarize? No, it's usually his own pictures.
John, I just want to thank you for these pictures that you bring. They rest on my door.
They get a bigger door.
I may need a bigger door.
I want to just bring a different perspective, and not my own, somebody else's, to long gone also, but in 1982, on my way back from Taiwan, I just very fortuitously happened to connect with this, probably one of the most interesting characters that came out of that whole Japanese East Asia co-prosperity zone that was so devastating for the rest of the world, you know, and or at least North China and Inner Mongolia during that time. But there was this very interesting teenager when he went there. His name was Hisao Kimura, and he went, and as he explains in his memoirs, that he went on this Japanese version of, at that time, which was the Peace Corps, which was kind of, you know, almost an oxymoron in the context of Japanese policy in that area. But his job was to go to Inner Mongolia and develop a sturdier type of sheep that gave more wool and, you know, tasted better or whatever. And because the Allies had stopped wool shipments to Japan in the late 30s after the invasion of China in 1937. So, I mean, you know, this is all the stuff that he realizes and becomes aware of over the next decade, and is quite critical, actually, of Japanese involvement and intent, because they perverted that youthful Peace Corps kind of, you know, let's go help these natives out and that kind of atmosphere. Ideology into a craven political ends, and to continue the political domination of that area. But he has just this. Why this book is not a movie, I'll never understand. Partly because it was first published in Japan in the mid 50s and created quite a stir. And whether they did anything over there, I don't know. But I didn't realize it had been published in English until just a few weeks ago, actually. It's been published over 20 years now. So, but getting back, I fortuitously made contact with Hisao Kimura from Taipei, and he agreed to see me in Tokyo when the plane stopped as like a stopover. And he came to my hotel. It was just really a delightful morning and part of the afternoon before I had to go. And then 20, you know, now that's 30 years later, I realized his book, and I had heard word of mouth because he went through the whole decade masquerading as an Inner Mongolian Lama whose name was Dawa Sangbo, you know. So that kind of, all these little, you know, reactions. So we met, we had a nice time, and came back, and 30 years later, his book is out in English and had been for 20 years. And I didn't know it, you know, until I ran across a brief reference on Kalimpong in the 1940s. So, you know, yeah, I ordered, you know, got on Amazon, looked it up, and got all the information, got it. And I'm reading through this book, and then this is 1946 in Kalimpong. And he's staying, at some point the Peace Corps stuff is abandoned and he becomes a full-fledged spy. He's sent over to spy to see because he speaks Mongolian fluently now and can really pass as a Mongolian, although the monk part was added later when he became a spy, but you know, he was masquerading as an Inner Mongolian, traveling through Inner Mongolia, trying to get to Northwest China to see if the Allies were building either a road or airstrips to supply the anti-Japanese resistance in North China and Burma. That was his assignment when he left Inner Mongolia in 1943. Well, through this harrowing, all kinds of events, and real life stuff too, you know, it's not just made up in some scriptwriter's mind. He goes through bandits and the caravans, and he talks about it. He can't get to Northwest China, to Xinjiang. He has to detour to Tibet because nobody would take him because he'd be killed or, you know, bandits and the whole thing. So he ends up in Tibet. But once he gets to Tibet, he hears rumors. It takes him 2 years, incidentally, overland. So it's already 1945, gets to Tibet, and, you know, it's like, oh, we don't know, you know, is the war over? Oh, we don't know. So he goes on this, like, you know, borrows money from a Mongolian guy who was a disciple of the Dilawa, who'd taken Japanese money to go find the Jetsundamba so they could do, I mean, there's all these kinds of things going on. And so he borrows money from Dilawa's guy, escapes to Kalimpong. And there in the newsreel, he sees the reality of what happened in Japan. You know, he said the only thing he recognized when they showed the newsreels of Tokyo was the Emperor's Palace. Oh. And General Tojo, you know, Admiral Tojo, whatever, you know, under guard. So he knew the game was over, but he couldn't give himself up. So he finds a job working for the only Tibetan language newspaper called Tibet Mirror, and the owner, he's a very interesting guy called Tarchin Babu. So I want to just read one, just a couple of paragraphs, and then I promise I'll sit down. I had company at the office, this is Tarchin's office, for also staying there as a regular guest of the Tarchins was a Kalmyk Mongolian Lama named Geshe Wangyal. He was not only a scholar of note, but he had a keen business sense, and that was one of the criticisms, the Kalmyks, when they were trying to foment that, oh, he's just a businessman, you know.
Among
other things, right? But he had a keen business sense and had amassed a fortune in trade between Lhasa and Peking. One of the most widely traveled Mongolian lamas, he had been as far as England as sutra instructor to Marco Palace. And that's when this picture was taken, obviously, right? One of the few Westerners up to that time who had made a serious attempt to understand the Tibetan religion from the inside. Geshe put his money to what is considered in Tibet the best possible use. The highest aspiration of every student monk is to obtain the degree of Geshe, Doctor of Divinity. But there is a lot more involved in this than 20 years of study and then passing a rigorous examination. The prospective graduate must also throw a feast for the entire monastery. Since there are more than 7,000 monks at Drebung, this involves a lot of money. Geshe Wangyal used his fortune to finance his poor but studious countrymen, so that no deserving Kalmyk Mongol ever went without a degree for want of funds. I was a little shy of him since he was so well traveled. When we first met, he remarked I did not look Mongolian, but he was to become one of my staunchest friends and supporters. So, and but in the book, he's kind of mild. When he met me, he said, when I met him, he said, oh, Geshe-la, the first time he said, he looked at him and said, you're not Mongolian. So I wanted to share that, that, you know, we're not making this up. This is what this guy, you know, like a Japanese agent, you know, in the, like at his most dire circumstances, let's say, you know, because he hasn't revealed that he's a Japanese agent, and he's, you know, and the enemy's won the war, and he's in enemy territory. Geshe-la befriended him, later was to lend the money to escape Tibet once again, and the whole thing. But so I ran across that, and I thought it'd be fitting to share. So, thank you.
Scholar in India after His Holiness came out of Tibet, and he also came over to this country. We brought him over in 1974 is what I remember. Yeah. And
that day he was born.
Genma's student that day was born. So then Genma stayed in this country and got a PhD from Columbia and improved his English and has been teaching for years in New York City since many years now. Has many loyal students.
37 years.
How many years?
37 years.
37 years, holy
smokes. He's 37 years old. And he
we
was
can
born.
Keep track, yeah. Right. Yeah. So, Gunnar has a very... I'd say Genma because he's also my teacher. We used to study with him. In fact, the one prayer here at the end that we were saying, I translated that.
Right after Bakshi died.
Right after Bakshi died, I translated that with Genma's help. So,
okay, I bowed on to Bakshi and Buddha the Bodhisattva. Today is Bakshi's memorial day. You wrote Bakshi is Sanskrit word. This be Bhikshu.
Bhikshu
become Bakshi. Right. And Tibetan Tibetan translation is Gelong. Then Bakshi was the beggar of virtue, beggar of merit. Tibetan word is Tibetan people know him. Geshe Wangyal.
Sopo Geshe Wangyal.
Yeah, Geshe Wangyal. Bakshi Geshe Wangyal. Bakshi, the word, even in Kashmir, Afghanistan, they used to use Bhikshu as a Bakshi. Very respected words, I think. Even the Bakshi Ghulam Mamat was a Kashmiri chief minister, a prime minister. His family name is still Bakshi. Today I am going to talk about effort and energy. Then Geshe Wangyal is the embodiment of effort and energy. You know, effort and energy. Then many young people here, like Geshe Wangyal, say, who is working hard, I like her, him, If people don't work, I don't like. And Geshe Wangyala always worked. Like John mentioned and David mentioned, he used to do business in Kalimpong between Lhasa for the sake of others, not for himself. And he was supporting all the young Geshes who are studying there, poor for them. And then I came here, invited Geshe Wangyal. I first met him in India. It was 1973. Then he was smiling. I did not know who is he. I'm repeating, but sorry. Yeah, Joshua also was there. Then I thought maybe some Tibetan aristocratic, maybe. I used to translate His Holiness Dalai Lama's lecture, one or two of them, into Hindi, from Sanskrit into, from Tibetan into Hindi. Maybe at that time, someone had seen me, then therefore he's smiling, I thought. Then Lama Lobdang told, "Is Geshe Wangyal." I knew by name when he came to Sanskrit University. I did not meet, but I heard. Also, he's a student, Sampan Nurbu. I don't know if he is alive or not.
It was Bakshi's.
Yeah,
it was Bakshi's student, disciples in
yes.
Kalimpong. Then Geshe always, they like he saw many clothes. Joshua used to have many clothes, I think. Sewn by Geshe-la and Diana, Natalie, myself, to
yeah.
several clothes I had. Then when he's not working, he play chess. Then in India, people playing chess, I thought, like Sirkun Rinpoche used to
yes.
play with Bakshi.
Yes.
Then Sirkun Rinpoche, one Mongolian monk, played playing chess there. Then I thought this is wasting of time, I thought. Then Geshe-la told me, "Oh, you should learn how to play chess. It is very good for your mind." Then he told me, who is weak, he take away his castle in the beginning.
That's right.
Then he told me, even I take away my queens in the beginning, you should learn. Then I played with him. Started to playing with him chess. Then he used to take the castle. Then he was very energetic. He saw all the many. He buy very cheap things, like sometimes the pawn somewhere. Maybe you still have armchairs. And
oh, yeah.
He covered
with half the leather. We still have some leather.
Yes, he covered with clothes. Like I am imitating like him. Professor Alex Roman had a warm jacket, worn out, but I covered with clothes. Like that Geshe-la used to do.
Right.
He's energetic. Therefore, if we make effort, then we will get energy. Then all of young people, he will be happy even he is not here. But his spirit is somewhere. And then all of young people have to make effort. That way you will learn, you will get virtue and energy. That way you become very successful and like Geshe-la. Then by the blessing of Geshe-la, I was able to meet Natalia and Philip, of course, Natalia, no, Philip, and that I was able to translate the sutra. This was this year published, then you got the copies,
yes.
Two volumes. Then recently, not recently, but 10 years ago, I translated Don't Stare. We are living with Philip, David Kite, and myself. This is called Patamba. Patamba, 100 instruction, Tengri Gyatsama. Then I got the copy for all of you. Then I request, if you possible, read it every day. It's a universal instruction, not only Buddhist, but for other who want to practice. If you can, every day. If you not, one day, at least once a month. If you read, then please take this book. I brought several copies.
Oh, thank and then, you
thank you for all of you meeting, seeing. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. Everybody, if you want a copy, you can come up afterwards.
Don't just take the tape. Only if you're going to use it. Otherwise, leave it here. So it's not just to have for material gain. Like, only for religious purposes.
Gana was saying, he said, if you have to commit yourself to reading it once a month, right, Gana?
Once a month.
At least once a month.
Then you can have it.
Otherwise not. Now I'll check up.
Amy?
Hey everybody, my name's Amy Miller, and I'm currently living in Charlottesville, Virginia, but a long time ago now, in 89 to 92, in there, I was a resident student here, and I've been a commuter and a Skyper since that time, always trying to maintain a connection to this place, and I like to say something at this event in part because to speak to those of us who never met Bakshi directly, as Josh was saying, this is, you know, in his talk, he was talking about directly and indirectly we've met Bakshi, so it's important for all of us to be here. But I wanted to start with something that we recited on page 10. The kind Reverend Lama is the foundation of all excellence. Seeing that proper reliance is the root of the path, may I rely on the Lama with great respect and continuous effort. Now that comes from Jade Tsongkhapa's Foundation of All Excellence. And in fact, Jade Tsongkhapa, when he composed the Great Treatise, which was translated here, he spends the first portion of his Great Treatise acknowledging the kindness of Atisha and talks about how his teachings are none other than what he got from Atisha. And if you look at the works of Atisha, Atisha mentions many of his teachers before him. And of course, we can go back and back to the Buddha. And even the Buddha acknowledged that what he was realizing and sharing with us was not something new. He created not something new and fashionable, but something that goes to all the Buddhas of the past. So, and interestingly, when Bakshi came here, I think some of the first things he worked on translating, it's interesting if you look at what Atisha did when he went to Tibet, he translated a variety of things, not just, you know, hardcore scholastic, knock him over the head with the tough stuff, but some sutras and some narratives, and if you look at the Foundation of All Excellence, what is that but an anthology that takes from here and there and gives us a lot
the
of
the Door of Liberation?
And the Door of Liberation, I mean, the Door of Liberation, that's what I meant. So anyway, I'm trying to speak to this idea, the Foundation of All Excellence, that Bakshi definitely, we can see from what everybody's saying, that he set up a very proper foundation for the teachings here and how lucky we are. And but what does it mean to follow the Lama if you've never met the Lama? I mean, clearly we have his example, and we hear his stories about him. But like Genjamspel was saying, his spirit is still here. And much in the same way that if you go on pilgrimage to Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha was, the Buddha isn't still alive, but we still have his teachings. And we still have his activities are still going forth. And Tibetans have this concept of ne, a place or a foundation. If you go to a pilgrimage spot, it's called a ne. It's a special place. And you know, go there to have some contact with the place and get some benefit. And it's a place where you go to get jhimma. You get blessings. But the blessings, unfortunately for us, are not magical fairy dust coming down. The blessings are about making some kind of transformation in your mind and making use of the teachings to get better yourself for the sake of others. And so, in a way, I was thinking that we can still meet with Bakshi here in this place. We shouldn't be disheartened that he is physically gone, because we meet with him when we meet with what he valued most, which is the teachings, what he sacrificed himself. And I'm saying this as a spoiled brat, really, because, you know, as has often been pointed out to me, you know, I wasn't one of the ones who came here and slept in a tent or ate lettuce sandwiches or cleared bushes. I all waltzed in and everything was all set up and there was a temple here and isn't this great? And I have been teased, you know, that the time that I spent here was really because I was growing out a very bad haircut. or that the food really was very good. So, but it's really not what it's about. What it's about is connecting with these teachings. And when I was here, a couple of very special teachers came. One was Dema Locha Rinpoche and Geshe Yashitapke, who many of you know, who's been continuing to come. And so I didn't get any direct precepts from Bakshi himself, but when they were here, Denma Locha Rinpoche did give us a whole summer of teachings, and after that summer of teachings, he said a couple of very short things. One was he asked his students who'd been with him all summer not to drink. I can hear it on the tape, you know, Coca-Cola, tum, have some Coke is fine, orange juice, but no alcohol, okay, if you want to be my disciple. He also said, don't go with bad friends. Always keep good friends. And this was very closely connected with what he said to me was, always support Joshua and Diana. Always give them your support. And never give them up. And also he said, always study the teachings. And I remember Diana was like, well, shouldn't she go to the movies sometimes? I mean, she gets really uptight. And he was like, no. You know, always study the teachings. And he was very serious about that. And he came another time, and I remember saying to him, I was just trying to be polite, and I don't know, remember the exact contents, but I said something to him, thank you so much for coming to our Dharma Center. And he looked at me, and he said, this is my Dharma Center. And I thought about that a lot since he said that, and you know, what was he trying to teach me? And I'm sharing with you all for a purpose, which is, he wasn't prancing around, becoming the next head lama at this place. He was saying to me something about, you know, you have to feel some sense of connection here, some sense of ownership, some sense of this is ours. This is something we value, and that we value enough to do something here, put some energy into this place. And if you look at his behavior and Geshe Yashitapke's behavior, Dema Locha Rinpoche is a phenomenal master, and Geshe Yashitapke, I mean, well, when we went to Atlanta, I saw how other Tibetans interacted with him, and he's a scholar beyond our wildest imaginations, and yet when they come here, they're very respectful. They're not trying to, I mean, it's clear that that Bakshi set down the roots, and they're respectful to Bakshi, and what's highest here is the teachings. And that's very clear. It's always the teachings that's the highest. They never put themselves out there. They're not here for an ego trip. And so I was thinking that we don't have specific precepts that we were given directly from Bakshi, but, Josh and John, my husband, took down a sign recently from outside, but they kept a little portion of it that's when you walk underneath it, what is it? It's like a little mantra.
It's a
little blessing.
And then
you put it in the...
Yeah.
I don't know.
Or you put it over the door. Right? We don't have one.
We'll put another one. We'll get another one.
But usually over the doorway, when you walk under it, then it has an effect of eliminating many aeons of sin that you've created.
Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah,
we'll be going in and out the door all the time. But I was thinking about the gate, and I was thinking that it's almost like there is a precept, some precepts on that gate.
It's on the gate. It's there.
Oh, really? On our yellow gate?
Of course.
Well, I'm having this. This is more of a metaphor for what I'm talking about, that Bakshi didn't give us direct precepts, but there is, in a way, sort of like a precept when you come in this place, that one is the feeling there's always something I can do to help. You know, that we're not here to take. We're here to study, but there's always something that we can give back. And so we all have that challenge. And the other thing is to study our buns off, not just for ourselves, but for other people. Because what Bakshi sacrificed so much for was for all of us to take these teachings and do something with them in our own lives and to help other people. So for us not to forget that purpose, that the purpose here is to promote and extend the teachings for the benefit of ourselves and others. And then the third thing I was thinking about was respect. That just like these really virtuous people who have come here with great respect for the teachings and for the positive seed, the pure seed that was established here, that we ourselves have to the best of our ability, check our egos at the door. And this place really is blessed so that if you stray from that, any of that, you will feel it. You definitely will, I guarantee it. You know, you have to set it aside and be here remembering what the purpose is and within the framework of being respectful. So that's what I wanted to say, and also acknowledge some feelings of gratitude for Joshua and Diana, how they sacrificed to continue the positive roots, keep nurturing those positive seeds so it can continue here. It's very important and admirable. And Natalie also have done quite a bit this last year, especially coming to support the work and how much we all benefit from that and value it and appreciate your hard work.
So marvelous, these stories and the historical perspective that were given, the spiritual perspective that were given on the vastness of Bakshi's true nature. And we receive so much from listening to them.
I can't hear you.
Yes, okay. So I'm going to talk about something kind of like a drop in the ocean of Bakshi's kind of kindness and the ways he taught. I'm just going to give some examples from the past. Diana said, "Why don't you tell a story before we came here?" So within that, I'm going to tell a story and then tell a little story from the sutra and then tell another little story. And I guess if I repeat, I'll probably repeat, and everybody can manage to hang in for another 5 minutes, something like that, I don't know. So remembering the kindness of Bakshi, my spiritual teacher, is like contemplating a great mountain, forest, or ocean. It is so vast, as there are so many deeds he did that were helpful to others. He taught tirelessly and happily, and he wanted us, his students, to put these teachings into practice in our lives. He encouraged us to become people who could live properly, as he said, and try to help others, whether as teachers, writers, doctors, administrators, lawyers, etc. And encouraged us to help at the center where, when we had time. And he'd always say, it will help you, you know, if you do that, which is true. Among the Buddhist teachings that he taught and lived were those to recognize and remember the kindness of others, to extend that to all beings, and to develop the wish to repay and return their kindness and express this through love, compassion, and the spirit of enlightenment. So the first step is to recognize the kindness of all beings, or at least one being. Story one. In the fall of 1967, I drove Bakshi from Freewood Acres to northern Connecticut, where he wanted to visit his student, Bob Fulton, a photographer and fledgling filmmaker. He wanted to talk to Bob's wealthy father to encourage him to support his artist son. It was a very rainy day, about a four-hour drive to Danbury, Connecticut from New Jersey. On the way, as Bakshi and I came to the New Jersey Turnpike toll booth, my small VW stopped and wouldn't start up again. A stranger in the car behind helped to push the car onto the side of the road. He figured the engine was wet and that it would dry out, or perhaps the battery was a problem. He helped by jump-starting the battery and leading us off to a gas station off the turnpike. Eventually, we got back on the road. A few miles down the road, Bakshi asked me if I took down the stranger's name so that I could write him a thank you. I hadn't. He asked it in such a way that I knew it would have been good to do so. Later on, I saw how often Bakshi would appreciate what his students and visitors did to help the center. For example, he would write or dictate many thank you notes, no matter how small the donation was. Remembering others' kindness was very important to him. And he showed in his actions that he thought it was important to return their kindness in some way, to reciprocate, even if it was a small thing like writing a letter. Although I was thinking many people treasure their letters from Bakshi, so people keep them. If something were done well, or if someone had a good motivation while doing something, Diana mentioned the other day about threading a needle, he would appreciate it. It was a frame of mind he wanted us to understand and develop. Now, the teachings say that it's impossible to repay the kindness of one's teacher, but they say that the best way to try to repay the Lama's kindness is to put the teachings he taught into practice. So I'm going to give an example from about the dire consequences of not doing this. From a sutra that Geshe Genjam Spel is translating, called the collection of sutras of Buddhist former lives called Karmashataka, which I have the pleasure of reading some of them. So I'll just give you a little snippet out of this one story. A poor woodsman living by selling grass and wood in the mountains was caught in a snowstorm while searching for wood. He took shelter in a cave where a bear lived, and when he saw the bear, he was terrified. This bear was a compassionate bodhisattva, however, who lived on roots and fruits and stored them in his cave. So he had full awareness. His mind was not that of a bear's. He spoke to the man to calm him, and for 7 days during the storm, he sheltered him with his body and gave him his stores of food. Then, as the woodsman was leaving to go home, the bodhisattva bear warned him not to tell anyone what happened, because other men would want to come and kill him. But upon meeting two hunters, the woodsman told them what happened, and the hunters decided to go find the bear and kill him. the woodsman, though recalling the bear's kindness, decided that he needed food also. So the bear was found and killed. However, when the woodsman tried to take his portion of the meat given to him by the hunters, the woodsman's hands fell off. Now, who was that? Later on, towards the end of the story, the Buddha Shakyamuni says, that was my cousin, basically, Devadatta, who was always sort of Buddha's sworn enemy. He was always trying to do something to harm him. Neither at that time did he have any sense of gratitude, nor did he give others credit, but made a waste of what they had done, unquote. So in contrast to that example of Devadatta, we see, of course, the great love and compassion of the Bodhisattva bear in that story. And Jay Tsongkhapa said in the great treatise that a Bodhisattva feels an incredible wish to return others' kindnesses. It is said that a kindness unrepaid weighs more than the heavy burden of the ocean together with Mount Meru, and that repaying others' kindness occasions the praise of the learned, unquote. So we might ask questions about this. Why does kindness unrepaid have such effects? One answer is that this is one of the ways that the karmic law works, just as an oak seed planted in the ground can produce a great tree. Logically, however, if we don't believe in rebirth, if we accept only one lifetime, in this case, it's unreasonable to imagine trying to repay even our parents' kindness in this life, in one life. Though we must certainly try in many ways to do so, even according to our culture's norms and ethics. Sometimes it feels that it's natural to want to repay, to return others' kindness, to reciprocate, but other times not. But Bakshi demonstrated that we can enhance the awareness of others' kindness and the wish to reciprocate. And finally, a further story, this connected to the previous first story that I was telling about this trip to Connecticut 45 or some years ago. We students, the next day, were out at Bob's father's garage working on a film about 30 minutes away, and Bakshi was alone in the small house that Bob had rented. There was little food there. We had planned to do shopping and bring back groceries later to make dinner. But we got back very late, feeling some shame perhaps. But Bakshi had already made food. How did he do that? We wondered. He had found some things in the nearly bare cupboards and that he had mixed with a few potatoes. I'm still not sure what was in it, but it was delicious. We asked him how he did it. He said, "I made it with love." But to me, that is the example of Bhakti. Loving and cherishing beings, having developed from deep wish to repay their kindness, being aware of all their kindness. He had this great love, which was really expressed and made up of many, many moments of teaching all his students and friends, and that you could experience in very small, you could say small ways in daily life. And I also want to thank, then, thinking of kindness, is of Josh and Diana for all their past and present consistent effort, their enthusiastic perseverance, directing and administering the center in so many ways, who, as His Holiness said in 2008 at Lehigh University, quote, "so faithfully, so very faithfully carry out the Lake Wangela's spirit," unquote. So what have they done? Well, I mean, we can't even name there. But for example, editing and preparing and translating and indexing the great treatise, okay, all three volumes, and bringing His Holiness here to teach many times, and for extending and promoting Bakshi's vision in so many ways, and doing this all with love and care. And yes, writing thank you notes. Okay. Thank you.
My name is Sally. Hello again. I never met Bhatshi in person, but as pretty much everybody has said, I met Bhatshi, I meet with Bhatshi every time I come here in this physical body now. When I first came here, I'm not sure what year that was, but it wasn't that long ago, 10 years maybe, whatever. I came here not because I'd heard of this place directly, per se. I came here because I met a man from Burma who was a monk, who was also a waiter in a little restaurant, who was searching for a place to pray. And I was dismayed. He was so very, very sad that he said he had nowhere to pray. And I'd heard that a place like this existed, not knowing that a Burmese monk would be having different prayers than necessarily a Tibetan monk might, but didn't matter. The man was sad. And after he fed me and we spoke a bit, I told him I knew of a place. So I've heard of a place near where I was, and that if I could find it, that was not easy, I might add, I would come back and get him if he wanted to come and pray. So I went on the journey to try to find here. I had no idea what its name was at all. I just knew kind of where Washington was. So I drove up to Washington figuring everybody up here would know where this place was, and it is not so then. And I finally, almost giving up, went into a natural health place of some kind, of thinking, well, if anybody here might know, it may be then. And if I cannot find it, I will give up for the day. And I walked in and I asked, and I, you know, and the woman behind the counter looked at me like I was nuts when I told her the story about why I wanted to find the place. And, you know, I was in my blue jeans, gardener, and whatever. Anyway, I guess I looked crestfallen, and I was turning to go, and she said, wait. She said, what's your name again? And I told them, her, my name was Sally, and she said, hold on, I have an idea. And she got the phone book, and she looked up what ended up being this number, and she made a phone call. And she was talking to somebody while I was standing there, thinking, what's going on? This is a little odd. And she looked at me and she said, here, this is Diana. She wants to talk to you. Okay, hello. And, you know, this person, Diana, asked me what I wanted. And I told her very quickly this story. And she said, well, you can't come right now because I'm about ready to go shopping. And I'm like, oh. I came all the way up for, I spent all these hours, and I thought, oh my gosh. And she must have felt that or something. I didn't say anything. And she's, wait, come right now. And I went, okay, how do I get there? And she started to tell me, I said, stop, I need a pen. The lady gave me a pen, and she said, go to the light and go 1.3 miles, then turn left. Go 1.3 miles. And I'm like, I'm listening to these numbers and these directions, and I'm realizing that something very beautiful was happening and had happened to me from, well, the moment I was born, but the moment I met the monk and he had his request for a place to pray. And all of my life, I have done my prayers wherever I could in many different ways. As it were, I got here with Diana's directions. I had the windows down in my car because it was a most beautiful day and for me. And I got to the gate, which she said I would know. She didn't tell me there was a gate, but she said, go up the road and you'll know us. And I'm like, oh gosh, I hope I do. And I got to the gate and I drove through. And with the windows open in my car, I heard this sound. And from that moment, that very moment, I knew I was home. And I found Diana at the door of her home, and we spoke and spent some time, and I prayed in the temple, and I felt home, as I do feel home here and now. And I have so very much love for your kindness and your dedication to your teacher, to the teachings, to all that this place represents for the whole world. And these teachings have traveled so far and to so many loving ways that I cannot say any other way but the joy that I have in my heart and the thanks I have for you. Thank you.
Tom has to talk about when his son came and sat in Bakshi's lap. Oh, I never did that. Bakshi plied him with candy and cookies. And that was special. I don't know what visit was that, Tom? When your son, John, was sitting on Bakshi's lap and you spent a whole afternoon with us. That was a wonderful time.
Tom was always taking pictures, too. And yeah. Tom and John, they must have a look up. The National Archives were the
He's shy, don't bother.
Anybody else have any story?
Rick.
Oh, Rick.
Oh, Rick.
Yeah. No, I'm still standing. Thank you. 35 years ago, I was lost in samsara. If you don't know what that means, you are living it every day. So that is this world. And I was, I'd been through a lot of different difficult situations, and I had been going up to New York to study with Cheng Man Cheng, a Taoist fellow who was teaching Tai Chi. And at that time, you see, my life had been changed, the first time when I went to the University of Pennsylvania and studied anthropology. And the first year, we had a course which went over all the world cultures in detail. Incredible amount of memorization. Who wants to know about the descent pattern of the Yoruba people of South Africa? Well, that kind of detail is what we were going through for every culture area in the world. But what happened is that it expanded my mind. So I saw a much larger world than I had been in when I came to university. But still, after that was my first big step, I think. And I started to see that this is a world that you were not just confined to one place. And I went on living my life as best I could using what I had from that experience. And I was up there, and I said I had become interested in a number of things, the occult Western tradition and a few other, and everything seemed to point to this thing called Buddhism, to Buddha. It became very attractive, and I think almost everybody I've met who's gotten involved in the slightest way with Buddhism, or the Buddha's teaching, get this kind of feeling that there's something right about it. And I keep finding that there's a yearning for people to know more about it. But they're so involved, we're all so involved in this world that maybe we can go to a meditation class or we go to something, but we never fully make that full commitment as Josh and Diana and so many other people in this room have. And I urge you to really think about making a commitment. You don't have to go to a monastery. Well, there I am in New York and I say, yeah, anybody know about Buddhism? Is there a place you can go? And in those days, there was nothing. I was from Philadelphia. There was no Buddhist Dharma Center. There was nothing. I had to, in order to get connected with Buddhism, I had to join the Buddhist Society of London and be a correspondence course and things like that. I just couldn't find any Buddhism. And if I asked this guy, he said, oh, he said, I've been going to this place in New Jersey and helping a Buddhist monk construct a temple. I said, that sounds pretty good to me. And you have the number? Yeah, I have the number. So I had the number, went back to Philadelphia where I was living, and I called up, and Joshua answers, and I get directions up here, and it was Columbus Day, because I was working, it was a day off. And so I said, what am I going to do? I'm going to this place, I don't know very much about Buddhism. I said, well, I went down to the Italian market and I got a big basket of oranges and a basket of apples, put them in the back of my old car and came up here. And so I finally found the place. And drove up, and I get out of the car and I look around, and all of a sudden Josh appears. He comes out of the doorway and he comes over and very welcoming and helps me take one of these baskets up to the door. And then I go in, I walk into this room. I don't know how to relate. I walk in with my shoes on. Right? I didn't get it. And over in the corner was this little guy in a robe, and I could see his long johns sticking out from the bottom of it. Well, okay. But then, I'll tell you, in the next couple hours, it was an experience. I encountered this man. More than a man. And of course the magic was that I was involved with the Buddhist Society of London, which had been so helpful in getting him here. And he immediately assumed that I was a full-fledged Buddhist somehow. And so he started talking with me, and then we went out and we walked around, and I had a list of questions for him. And as we talked, each one of the questions was being answered. It was amazing. Well, it may have just been that the kind of questions I have are the kind of such elementary questions that whatever he had said would have answered them. But it certainly impressed me. And that was my beginning. And then we had a nice lunch, Diana was working on that with other folks, and I didn't really want to leave. And so after lunch was work time. So we went out and we cut brush. Every one of these lawns that you see so beautiful was just filled with the densest brush that you find in the northern. In the eastern woodland forest.
It's a forest.
It was a forest, yeah. And so I cut brush. And the tools were pretty primitive, I'll tell you. And I remember Josh giving me his brush clippers, because mine were so difficult, and I wasn't a brush cutter. And I remember that to this day. I can almost feel the sun, and I'm looking at the bush and his kind offer. So that was just the beginning, and as much as possible, I came here. One of the most interesting things, really quickly, I know we all want to eat, was came one, I think it was 77, and I found that there was a new monk. And I found out it was Bhikkhu Bodhi. Now, I don't know if you know who Bhikkhu Bodhi is, but he was to become one of the foremost proponents of Theravadan Buddhism in the world. And I had an opportunity to start coming up here regularly, and as every time I could, and receiving teaching from him as well as other teachers. But then I found out he was a Theravadan monk. And I started running in. By that time I started to get to know some other Buddhist people, and they started talking about, well, we are Mahayanists. We're the highest vehicles. You know, we don't. But here, my experience here was no regard for the schools of Buddhism. It was, what is the Dharma being? Is the teachings, pure teachings being promulgated. So as a result, I've never had any trouble with any kind of label. Respect them all, and but I know where I think the best ones are for me. So I appreciate that. And I want to thank, we're going to eat. We're going to eat.
No. I'm really not that hungry.
1985, I was thinking, you know, maybe I should become a monk. So I said, I don't know very much, but let me explore it. And at that time, His Holiness was giving a two-week teaching over in Recon, Switzerland, northern Switzerland, teaching the many refugee Tibetans who were there. And there was a group of people there, and Glenn Alexandrin was involved and so forth. So I went over with him and his wife, and we went over as a group, and I found out many things. In fact, my wife went with us. I wasn't married then. She was my girlfriend. I don't think she knew that I was thinking of becoming a monk so much. But you know, it would have been all right for her. She would, you know, whatever I wanted to do, she was always my support, has always been my support. And so we went, we had a good time. I sat with the 5,000 people under the big tent in the barley field. And she, I think she saw most of Switzerland. And she's a very good Episcopalian, and continues that. And that is no problem for either one of us. The difference in faith traditions is no problem, absolutely not. So I just wanted to mention that. So, but I met all these monks from all over the world, and I soaked in what was going on, and I had at the last night of the Kalachakra. There is this ceremony where one puts kusha grass under various parts. And I had this dream that night that I was delivering papers in Philadelphia with the Dalai Lama. And he wasn't dressed like the Dalai Lama. He was dressed like the King of Siam. And he was in front of me putting the papers into the boxes for other people. An amazing dream. And I had a chance to briefly talk to His Holiness about that. And it was very clear to me that I would come back to Philadelphia and continue to do anything I could to promote the Dharma. So the next year we started the Philadelphia Buddhist Association with people from all over, all traditions. And it was the only Buddhist organization in Philadelphia at the time. Now it's all over. You know, now we have lots of schools who have come in. But this is home base. This has always been the first place. I think you fall in love with the first place you really hear the Dharma, the teachings. But I'm fortunate in knowing that I have really good teachings here. So I really appreciate all that you have done. I'm so proud that that I am associated with the place where the teachings are supreme. Thank you, Amy, for really emphasizing that, because that is what you do. It's the teachings, not the personalities. And the fact that Tsongkhapa's great text has been done here. And then there were so many scholars involved that it changed in some way scholarship in the United States among Tibetans. So this is a very important place. I hope, you know, they don't hit you over the head. You don't have extended retreats like some places do, but it's here. The teachings are here, and the fact is that it's up to us to get the teachings. There's no cult of you have teachers, but it's not a cult, if you know the difference. I think that's very important to understand. You have the responsibility to find the teachings and to follow them. So thank you for keeping that foremost. I don't think there's anything else I need to say. I've said too much already, so thank you very much.
Some samba from Ladakh is there.
Oh, wonderful.
And make some soup.
Thank you.
They bring he brought some flowers.
Maybe the muffins have to go now. Okay.
She says it's here.
And don't forget your book. You want to get your book from the chair. She knows about it.
Yes, chairs away. That would be very nice.
What were you thinking about the samba, Gemma?
Patambaya.
Oh, Patambaya.
We did it.